Welcome everybody, and thank you very much once again to Zeifman's as well as the Bayit and Shari Shemayim for partnering with us at Beit Midrash Zichron Dov for the series. This is the third in our May series. God willing, there will be some kind of a series coming up in the fall, but I don't have any details yet on who's going to give it, how it's going to be given, and so on. There will be letters of participation going out, I hope, by email next week. Please make sure that you sign in via the Zoom chat. Even if you signed up for the class, we still need you to actually sign in. And if you could please keep the screen on, anybody who could, that would be great. It's a lot more fun and a lot easier to give a session like this when I can see you. I am not recording video. No one is disturbed by seeing you eat lunch. So that would be helpful. Our topic today is the gifted auditor, the ethics of swag. So I actually thought that everybody knew what swag was, but I got a couple of emails from people wanting to know what swag is. So the definition I gave them: gifts from employers, clients, vendors, often from people who may expect you to then recommend their products or their services to others. It exists in many different industries. Doctors are invited to conferences which are sponsored by drug companies, or something as simple as, you know, they give out free gifts, pens, notebooks, whatever. I'm getting a message that the connection in this space is unstable, the internet connection. Are people able to hear me all right? Yeah? A little dicey. That's what happens when you switch spaces. Unfortunately, I don't know anything about this space or what the best angle is going to be. So I'm going to do the best I can with it. Let me know if it really becomes problematic. Okay. Again, swag are gifts that one is given that come with a certain expectation that you're going to recommend products, that you're going to recommend services. This sort of thing comes up in a lot of different ways. If you look at your source sheet, I gave you a couple of recent headlines, one pulled from the left, one pulled from the right, one regarding Justin Trudeau and his vacations, the other one involving, in the U.S., Chief Justice Clarence Thomas, and his issues. I deliberately just picked one from the left, one from the right. You could just as easily bring many, many more cases. That's not where I'm really going today. But clearly, CPA Ontario is not a fan of the idea of accountants in general, and especially auditors, people engaged in providing assurance services, receiving presents. That's not okay. If you take a look at source number 3 on the sheet, this comes from the preamble of the CPA Code of Professional Conduct. Clients, employers, and the public generally expect that members and firms will bring objectivity and sound professional judgment to their services. It thus becomes essential that a member or firm will not subordinate professional judgment to external influences or the will of others. The principle of objectivity underlies the rules related to potential conflicts of interest, as well as the requirement for independence in relation to the performance of assurance engagements. For anyone who's not familiar with assurance as a term, we're talking about basically auditing services. We're going to define it a little bit more finely in a little bit. But it's where you're supposed to be auditing somebody, you need to be independent. With respect to both independence and conflicts of interest, the profession employs the criterion of whether a reasonable observer would conclude that a specified situation or circumstance posed an unacceptable threat to a member's or firm's objectivity and professional judgment. So it's what a reasonable observer would conclude. Only then, when you are free and clear of any suspicion, can public confidence in the objectivity and integrity of the member or firm be sustained? And it is upon this public confidence that the reputation and usefulness of the profession rest. The reasonable observer should be regarded as a hypothetical individual who has knowledge of the facts which the member or firm knew or ought to have known, and applies judgment objectively with integrity and due care. I want to come back to that line a little bit later, because it's an important line in terms of what exactly our concern is about who's going to think what about what's going on. But basically, there has to be objectivity, and there has to be the appearance of objectivity. So on the one hand, you've got the situations that we describe in the first couple of sources involving Justin Trudeau and involving Clarence Thomas, and on the other hand, the demands of the CPA code. To take this over into Jewish law, I brought you a Gemara in source number 4. And this, you can see the Hebrews at the bottom of one side, the English to the top of the next side. I'm just going to work from my English translation, but you can see the original there as well. Thank you also to the person who sent me a private note in the chat explaining that SWAG stands for stuff we all get. Okay. If you take a look at source number 4, the Talmud is talking about bribery concerns. And it says, and what is a verbal bribe? And they give you 3 stories. Verbal bribery, meaning not giving money. Like when Shmuel, the sage, not the prophet from Tanakh, but the sage, crossed on a ferry. He was crossing a river on a ferry. And someone extended his hand to him. Shmuel asked, "Why are you here?" He replied, "I have litigation." And Shmuel said, "You helped me across the river. I am disqualified to judge for you." And thank you to the person who sent me a note in the chat on other ways to read that acronym for SWAG. Thank you. A Maimar was judging when a feather landed on his head. Someone removed it. A Maimar asked, "Why are you here?" He replied, "I have litigation." A Maimar said, "I am disqualified to judge for you. You helped me out. You preserved my appearance to the public by taking the feather off my head. Now I can't judge for you." Finally, Mar Ukva, another sage, spat before himself and someone covered it. Mar Ukva asked, "Why are you here?" He replied, "I have litigation." Mar Ukva said, "I am disqualified to judge for you." All 3 cases, rabbis disqualify themselves from judging cases for what would seem to be fairly minor favors. Right? I mean, helping him off the ferry, he's got something on his head and, getting rid of it, or covering up his saliva when he spat. These aren't major assistance. Nonetheless, those are all disqualified. I'm going to come back to that level of concern in a minute, but I just wanted to show you the last case here. Rabbi Ishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, had a field. He didn't work in the field himself. There was somebody who rented the field as a sharecropper. So the sharecropper of Rabbi Ishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, regularly brought him a basket of the rabbi's own fruit on Fridays. Every Friday he brings him the fruit from the orchard. Once he brought it to him on Thursday, or the field, either way. Once he brought it to him on Thursday. So Rabbi Ishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, said, "Why did you do it differently this time?" He said, "I have litigation. And I said I would bring it to the master while I'm here. I figure I'm coming on Thursday anyway. Let me just bring the fruit." He didn't accept it from him. He said, "I'm not taking it." And he said, "I am disqualified to judge for you. Number one, I can't take the fruit. And number two, I'm not going to judge the case either, even though this is his own stuff." He set up a pair of sages and they judged for him. He set him up with others to take care of the judgment. While he was walking, Rabbi Ishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, is walking along. He says to himself, "You know, if he wants, he could argue this way in his case. If he wants, he could argue this way in his case." And then he said to himself, "Wow, I'm already on this guy's side. May the recipients of bribes perish. I did not accept it. And had I accepted it, it would have been my own. And this happened. How much more so for recipients of bribes?" He says, "Wow, that's a really remarkable, that's a really remarkable degree to which I can be bribed. That even when I didn't accept it, and it was my own produce, and I'm still influenced. It's a very high standard. One last source indicating the standard regarding concerns for bribery and conflict of interest is source number 5. A response from Rabbi Mordechai Yaakov Breisch. He was, as you see on the sheet, originally from Poland. He was then in Germany. Then World War II happened, and he survives the war, and he goes to Switzerland. There were a couple who did, a couple of leading rabbis who did that. So he deals with the following question. In the event that a judge loses property, and somebody else finds it and returns it to him, does that disqualify that judge from being a judge on his case? And the answer that Rabbi Breisch brings is that he should not judge, at least as a matter of special piety, if not actually by law. Where does all of this come from? So all of that, I mean, it's based on, and he writes it, number 5, it's based on the Talmud that we saw in source number 4. But is this really our standard? And then once I get through this point, I'm going to take comments and questions and start to discuss how it applies potentially to an auditor. But I want to show you sources 6 and 7. Source number 6 is a rabbinic comment which says that all those cases that we just described in source number 4, the ones about the feather on his head and helping him on the ferry and covering the saliva and bringing him his fruit, all of those cases are actually just personal stringencies. That's not letter of the law. Tosfot here in source number 6, he says, Eino ala chumra be'alma, it is only a stringency, for they were strict with themselves, as we find in various areas, but they were not disqualified. These judges were not actually disqualified in source number 6. That's one view. However, Rabbi Yosef Karo comments on a line from the Rambam, from Maimonides, in source number 7. Maimonides brought all of these cases in his code of law. And Rabbi Karo says, our master, meaning the Rambam, thought that in all of these cases they refrained from judging not only out of piety, but because this was the letter of the law, and not like the view of Tosfot, who wrote that this was just piety. So two different approaches. One saying this is actually letter of the law, that you can't judge cases for somebody who did such a favor for you. Okay, I've just been monologuing a lot. Questions and comments from you before we move into how all of this becomes relevant. Nope. 10 minutes and it's all clear. Yeah. Okay. George, were you saying something? Or are you just... No. Okay. So, let's turn to apply this. What is required of somebody in a position of authority in terms of accepting gifts? And that's where this becomes relevant beyond a judge in a court, and to an auditor in an assurance relationship. So I gave you a few cases, which we're not going to read out yet, but I want to have 3 particular applications to this. One will be receiving a small gift, not a huge gift, but something small. The second will be working for a company both as an auditor and providing non-assurance services. That'll be the second case. And then the third case, a case that can easily come up in a Jewish community. You have a relationship socially, and somebody sends you shalach manos for Purim, right? Gifts that are normally given, that are relatively small, usually. Does the existence of that social relationship, as well as the receipt of shalach manos, does that create any sort of conflict of interest? Those are the 3 cases that we're going to be looking at. But before we do that, we have to go through some important prefaces which really set the stage. The first preface is that even though the source that we saw in number 4 and what we saw in number 5, really 4 through 7, all spoke about judges, that doesn't mean that in Jewish law only judges have a concern for conflict of interest. it extends beyond judges. So if you take a look at source number 8, Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Heller, just out of curiosity, anybody here know themselves to be a descendant of Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Heller? A little bit of an odd question, but if you're a descendant, you know why I'm asking. His descendants are very big on identifying as descendants of Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Heller. There was even, I knew one who said there was a reunion that they used to go to for the descendants of Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Heller. It's a big thing. In any case, he wrote the following comment in his Pilpulei Charifta. He says, in source number 8, after making a particular comment about the importance of public officials avoiding anything that could present a conflict of interest, he says, I wrote this to teach that public officials, even though their decisions are not Torah judgments, and they're not empowered for that, they're not judges on a court, they still must be careful not to accept gifts for their rulings. In other words, it applies to people who are in authority overall. It's not only about the judge. Someone that sent me a message in the chat, a cousin of his, said she was a descendant of Rabbi Heller. So that's there's one right there. In another example of how this extends beyond judges, source number 9. This is a great story or a terrible story, depending on which part of the story you were in. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, writing in the 18th century in Hungary, dealt with a situation in which there was a community that was picking a rabbi, and there was a vote in the community on who was going to become the rabbi. And there were multiple candidates, and apparently supporters of one of the rabbis bribed people to get them to vote for that rabbi. The rabbi was not aware, and there was a vote. The rabbi won, and then the story came out. And now what do you do? So take a look at source number 9, where you get a little bit of the story from Rabbi Sofer's responsum on it. The people of a certain town gathered to hire a rabbi and teacher, and they agreed regarding 4 rabbis to place their names into a box and then to vote on each name as it would be withdrawn. So I guess they pull one out of the box, and then they have everybody submit their votes in a basket, and then the next one out of the box, and people put their votes. I don't know exactly how they did it. The third candidate won the majority of votes. After several days, the masses raised a stormy voice, for many of the people had accepted monetary bribes from the relatives of that rabbi to appoint him upon them. So Rabbi Sofer says, it is as obvious as the kashrus of an egg in yogurt. That's a term from the Talmud. When you want to say something is so obvious, it's that, you know, eggs and yogurt are kosher, basically. There's more to be said about it, but that'll suffice. So he says, it's so obvious that this vote is void, for they were required to voice their opinions altruistically. And he quotes the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, saying that when there is a community vote, everybody has to vote altruistically. They cannot be bribed by others. And Rabbi Sofer argues that this is based on the model of judges. There are those who disagree and think that there are other reasons for it, but the point that I'm trying to make is that it's not only about being a judge. In Judaism, the concern for conflict of interest is not judge specific. It extends to those who are in authority, and it even extends to community members who are voting on something. And therefore, clearly, it will extend to auditors. Clear? Good? Okay. The second point that I want to make as introduction is that the problem that we're dealing with here is not criminal intent. The issue is not that we think that the auditor is a bad person, and when somebody gives the auditor, you know, a gift, now they're going to deliberately slant their presentation of the case. Rather, what we're saying is that the auditor is going to be subtly influenced in terms of their objectivity. And that was something that we saw in the CPA code, in the preamble that I brought in number 3, where they emphasize this is the principle of objectivity. And it's also seen in the Talmud. There's this very interesting line in source number 10. The word in Hebrew for a bribe is what? Shochad. Shochad, exactly. Shochad. That's the word for a bribe. So the Talmud in source number 10 asks, why is a bribe forbidden? Once one accepts a bribe from someone, one's mind becomes close to him. And he is like his person. It's like he is you. You can't see guilt for yourself, and you won't see guilt for this person. And they have a play on the word shochad. They read it as shehu chad, which could mean it is sharp, but more likely means it is one. This person becomes the same as you, because you start to see their interests as your interests. That's the problem. We're not worried about criminal intent. We believe in general that people are good, number one. And number two, there are legal penalties for bad behavior. We're concerned about somebody who won't even know that he's behaving badly because he's biased. That's where we're concerned. And we're most concerned where they have discretion. And here I want to point out a very interesting quirk in Jewish law. Take a look, please, at source number 11. This is regarding judges, but it also is regarding witnesses. Anyone who is disqualified to judge a case is disqualified also to testify as a witness, except there's a disqualification for judges that doesn't apply to witnesses, where there's an issue of familiarity. Somebody is a friend or somebody is an enemy. The judge is not allowed to judge in such a case. You see that in number 12 as well. However, the witness is allowed to testify either about a friend or about an enemy. Why would a judge be prohibited, but a witness be permitted? What's the rationale? Why would you allow somebody to testify in a case involving a good friend or an enemy, but you wouldn't allow him to be a judge for a case involving a friend or enemy? Sorry?
A character witness.
Right, but even a witness about the event itself. Why would I say that you're not allowed to judge, but you are allowed to serve as a witness? And therefore?
So if he has information to provide on the case, friend or enemy, he still has to provide it. He just can't judge on it.
But why are we allowing him to be a witness? He's going to be biased.
Well, can't the judge take that into account?
The judge, who doesn't know the party, can take into account what the witness is saying.
That's and the relationship the witness has with the other person.
A fair point. I want to go a little bit beyond that, but it's definitely a fair point. Someone sent me a note in the chat saying basically that witnesses are a limited supply. It's one thing to knock out the judge because the judge is a friend, so someone else will judge. But what if this is the only person who saw the case? It's a very interesting point. So I'm going to point you to source number 13, Rabbi Yeshua Falk, the Sma, in which he argues that there's fundamentally something different between the act of testifying and the act of judging. He says, in testimony, he testifies about what he saw. We do not suspect that he would intentionally alter it for love or hatred. This is not so in judgment, which depends on logic. One's mind changes due to love or hatred even without evil intent. The argument he's making is not one that psychologists today would sustain. He says, a witness testifies as a matter of observation. What did you see? What didn't you see? And it's straightforward. Whereas a judge testifies about what they think. I see that the internet connection is unstable again. This is frustrating. Can you still hear me? Doesn't sound like it. Can you still hear me? Yeah? Okay. So, the statement that Rabbi Falk makes is the judge is exercising discretion. And because the judge is exercising discretion, right, it's their decision of which opinion they accept and which argument they follow, we have concerns about the we have concerns regarding their potential influence that they experience. The witness is just reporting what the witness saw. We don't think he's a bad person, and we think that he's not going to be biased by what he saw. I say that this will be difficult for psychologists, because in psychology we generally assume that even someone who thinks that they're reporting objectively what they saw is biased by whatever they brought into it, right? There have been all sorts of studies where they show people a scene and the person's response is not exactly what they saw. When they're asked questions about the scene, they get things wrong, and some of it can be based on the bias. But that's the idea that Rabbi Falk is suggesting here. Not unlike the point that was made regarding judges, I think it was Rebecca who said it, that the judge can exercise discretion regarding what the witness says. The judge has the opportunity to take into consideration the witness's relationships. If the judge has relationships, that actually becomes problematic. So, taking this idea that there's a difference, and the more discretion you have, the greater the concern. Rabbi Sofer, in source number 14, dealing with that story about the community where people were bribed in the vote for the rabbi, he says, those who accepted bribes may not enter this gathering at all. They're done. They're not able to be involved in voting anymore on this decision. Even after they return the bribe and accept with an oath that they will never accept a bribe for this again, still they may not be counted at all. Perhaps they're even permanently disqualified from any vote until they repent. But for this vote, they are certainly disqualified forever. Once their minds have become close to the bribery candidate, they will never retreat from that. They are viewed as interested parties forever. So the concern is you've lost objectivity, and therefore we're worried about your ability to decide things objectively. You know, it was interesting. We actually had a class on this subject, bless you, by Baruch Weintraub, who was the scan with our Beit Midrash. It's got to be, I don't know, 10, 11 years ago that he gave the class on it. So I emailed him and I asked him to share with me what he did with this. And he had a similar idea to what I'm suggesting here, which essentially is the more discretion you have, the greater our concern. The less discretion you have, the more what you're doing is just objective in its own right, the less concern we have. And this comes up in differentiating between different kinds of assurance services. If you take a look at source 15 from CPA Canada, new agreed upon procedure standard creates opportunities for practitioners. They're talking here about, I'm blanking on what AUP stands for. Agreed upon procedures, right? Agreed upon procedures. In conducting an AUP engagement, the practitioner does not express an assurance conclusion, but instead performs the procedures that have been agreed with the engaging party as being appropriate for the purpose of the agreement. The practitioner communicates the procedures performed and the findings in the AUP report. Users of the AUP report consider the findings based on the procedures performed and draw their own conclusions. It's analogous to the witness case. You just have certain things that you're supposed to do. You don't decide which things to do, which things not to do. And then you provide the information, and others are going to use it to draw their own conclusions. In contrast, an assurance engagement involves the evaluation or measurement of a subject matter, such as financial transactions and events, against a set of criteria to reach a reasonable assurance conclusion, such as an audit opinion, or a limited assurance conclusion, such as a review conclusion. The practitioner determines the procedures that need to be performed in order to obtain the evidence needed to reduce the risk of expressing an inappropriate conclusion to an acceptable level, and draws their own conclusion from the evidence obtained. That is of greater concern. The AUP case, the agreed upon procedures case, there's less of a concern about the potential problems that could come from accepting gifts. Your auditing, that's a much more serious consideration. Clear? How are we doing? Okay? Okay. So that was the second introductory note. I feel like the first two classes were a lot more fun. I had more cases and less introduction. But we'll get through this. But those are the first two points. Number one, it's not just judges, it's anyone in authority. And number two, the main concern here is objectivity. That's really our issue. And therefore, the more control you have of the situation, the greater our concern about lack of objectivity. That's the idea. Third point. The harm that we're talking about goes two ways when we're talking about somebody being biased and somebody losing objectivity. One is the fiduciary responsibility to the client. You have a contractual obligation to your client. You accept something from somebody, it causes you to make a bad decision. That was clear in the preamble. It's also clear in Jewish law. Source number 16 talks about a different type of person who's in charge of something. It talks about an apotropos. An apotropos is a legal guardian. Somebody is appointed by the court to be responsible for the affairs of someone who is not capable of managing them personally. So some say, says source number 16, Rabbi Moshe Isserlis in the Shulchan Aruch, some say that just as a guardian may invest with others, so he may accept the investment for his own ventures. Just like the guardian is able to say, I am managing this money and I'm going to invest it in whatever enterprise, I can invest it in my own enterprise. I know it's a good enterprise. So long as the rabbinical court oversees it, but you need oversight directly by the rabbinical court. They're the ones who make the decision. Why? Not because he's a bad guy, but out of concern for gossip. We are concerned about what people are going to say. So that brings me into two points. Number one, if there's no rabbinical court oversight, then I have concern in general about self-interest. But number two, I'm concerned about what people are saying. In accounting, we call that the reputation of the profession. We're concerned about what people are going to believe. And on that basis, we say that you have to make sure that the reasonable person would not think there's a problem in what you're doing. In Jewish law, as brought in source number 17 from the Talmud Yerushalmi, we have a mitzvah of avoiding suspicion from others. You shall be innocent in the eyes of others. And that's why we said the legal guardian needs oversight to avoid gossip from others. So that's our third introductory point, right? Our first introductory point is it's not just judges, it's anybody in power. Our second point is our concern is for objectivity and the loss of objectivity. And our third point is that the concern that we have here is not just are you going to lose objectivity, but what are other people going to think? Last point of introduction, and then we can finally get to our cases. We have to live with this problem, meaning we have a philosophy which you saw noted in the preamble of acceptable. Actually, was it in the preamble or is it a different source? Let me just see. Oh, I see. It was the end of source 15. The piece from CPA Canada. We had it there. It was probably in the preamble as well. But the key is what you saw at the end of 15, which is you have to reduce the risk of expressing an inappropriate conclusion to an acceptable level. The reality is that 100% insulation against interest is impossible. There's no way that you're actually going to be able to avoid all conflicts of interest, especially if you take the standard that we saw in the Talmud in the very beginning about removing the feather from his head and helping him across the river and giving him his own basket of fruit. If that were really a law and there was no way that you could come up with a level of acceptable risk, we would have no judges. And we want there to be judges and we want there to be accountants. It's good for society to have accountants available, right? Source number 19, years ago we had a session on ethical advertising and the tension between allowing advertising and on the other hand, fearing some of the negative consequences that come with advertising services. And what we said then in source number 19, I quoted it from the CPA code, it is in the public interest and in the interest of all members and firms of CPA Ontario that members and firms be allowed to advertise or otherwise promote services available on the basis of fees charged. You want people to have accountants available. In the event that you are going to be severe in restricting this, you know, because of interest concerns, you won't have accountants available. And the same thing is true within Judaism. We want goods and services to be available to people. So what we do is we compromise. We compromise, first of all, regarding payment for services. In Jewish law, the community pays the judges. That's generally the way it works. That's the ideal. That's what we would like to see. We saw that in the first session in our series on the living wage. If you look at source number 21, this was the source that we saw then about judges in Jerusalem who were paid from what was called the Lishka collection, the half shekel donation that everybody made every year. That was used to pay the judges. That's one example. In source number 22, you see the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, which talks about how we fund judges outside of Jerusalem and beyond Talmudic times. The practice is to make a collection for the court, setting a tax to support the court, collecting at the start or end of the year. There is no issue of bribes or payment, for all Israel is obligated to support their judges and sages. So you do it from the community. However, the judge is restricted in what the judge can take. One who takes payment to judge, all of his rulings are void. That's a starting point. Unless it is known that he did not take payment for that particular ruling. And if he only takes payment for refraining from other work, that is permitted. If all he takes is what's called in Hebrew schar batala, what it is I could have gone into accounting and I would have made X. You're paying me what I could have made in accounting and therefore I'll be a judge instead. That's permitted if everybody knows that this is only payment for refraining from other work, and if he's being paid by the litigants, he has to accept from both parties equally. That's the requirement. So the judge can be paid by the community. The judge may even be paid by the litigants, but only if it's payment for not doing other work and the litigants pay equally. In society, I'll ask you the question, and Larry, thank you very much for your help in preparing this part of the session. Who pays for assurance services? Someone other than Larry can answer it. Who pays?
I can answer too.
Okay, go ahead.
The client pays for the assurance services.
Right. The client pays for assurance services. So that means, here I am as the accountant, and I am reviewing your books, and it's up to me to decide whether there's a problem, whether there's something you're going to have to invest in fixing, but you're the one paying my salary. Why are we not concerned that I am biased on behalf of the client?
So, you know, the accountants are all subject to professional responsibilities as members of our institute.
Yeah.
And, you know, we are, the institute is a self-regulatory organization, and we're answerable to them. Our practices are inspected by them as regulators. Right. And we have to maintain systems of quality control to make sure that we remain independent and that we follow required standards.
Right. So basically, what I'm hearing from you, and thank you, is there are penalties if the auditor is in fact found to have acted on this conflict of interest. Number one, and number two, we have rules and procedures that are meant to minimize the risk. But, and, you know, one of those points being, for example, that the fee cannot be affected by the result of the audit, right? That would be a pretty clear one. Thank you.
But one other thing that you can take into account.
Yes, Jerry.
There's one other thing that you take into account. It's one, it's a basic thing in quality control, learning quality control, that if you have separation of duties.
Mm-hmm.
So in an audit situation, generally speaking,
you have somebody afterwards reviewing the file called an EQCR, which is a person that reviews the file of the partner who is supposed to be independent of the partner and answerable to the firm executive or firm in fact, and he's separate from the actual partner. So you would have to have collusion if in a situation where you know, there was things untoward.
Interesting. I didn't know about this. EQCR?
Yeah. Engagement Quality Control Reviewer.
Got it. I did not know about that. Thank you. That's good to know about. The fundamental point that I think we see is that you don't have another way to do it. You don't have an option. You know, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, envisions judges being paid by a community collection. But it recognizes that sometimes that's not the way it's going to work, and the litigants are going to be the ones who actually pay for the community, for the judge. And the way it'll have to work is make sure they pay equally. But there's a recognition that we need judges, and here there's a recognition we need auditing, and the community is not going to pay. We're not creating a communal fund for auditing services. So it's going to end up being paid for by the client, and we just have to do our best to diffuse the concerns. And there are a lot of concerns. In number 23, I brought you from the CPA code, the concerns for various types of interests. Independence is potentially affected by self-interest, self-review, advocacy, familiarity, and intimidation threats. We're going to talk more about the self-review threat in a little bit. The mere existence of such threats does not per se mean that the performance of a prospective engagement is precluded. The undertaking or continuation of an engagement is only precluded where safeguards are not available to eliminate or reduce the threats to an acceptable level, or where Rule 204.4 provides a specific prohibition. But generally speaking, it's about damage control. That's really what it amounts to. So, we say that this applies to all people who have a risk of interests clouding their independence. We are not concerned for criminality. We're concerned about a subtler influence on judgment where the auditor starts to feel close to the audited party. We are concerned for harm to the client and those who are relying directly on the audit. And we're worried about the reputation of the profession on the whole. And number four, we accept a degree of risk from conflict of interest. So with all of that in mind, let's handle our three cases. So if you go back to the first slide, I really would have liked to have made more of this about the cases. It's a lot more interesting that way. That's the way it goes. Actually, it's not the first side. It is the second side. Cases. Accounting firm Bitachon LLP is retained to provide ongoing assurance services for Food Incorporated, a chain of 30 grocery stores. One day, Food Incorporated finalizes a deal to open 10 more stores. To celebrate, they distribute bottles of fine wine to every employee in their main office. They offer wine to the on-site accountants of Bitachon LLP. May the accountants accept. This is kosher wine, and they're not going to drink while they're auditing. So what would you say? Are the accountants allowed to accept the bottles of wine? You'd say yes. Why?
It's insignificant.
Now, the thing is not significance. The significance is not the criteria here. The criteria here is, in the situation, is what would a normal human being, a normal, independent person, do?
Okay.
That is the criteria. Would everybody, or not everybody, but would most people say, yeah, that's something you do, then you can do it. If most people would say, no, that's a no-no, can't do it. That's the criteria in all of this, in all of your cases. It's what an average, impartial person would normally do.
What do you what happens when you encounter a new case?
I didn't get it. What would happen is?
If you encountered a brand new case that you've never dealt with before, you don't know what reasonable people would do.
Well, you put yourself into the position of a third party reasonable person, judge yourself and say, listen,
okay.
What would the party say?
Okay. George, you were going to say?
I think in this case, well, everybody got it, so you're really not outside of it. You're not going to take it looks embarrassing here. So you're not being isolated, you're not being pinpointed, and you're just like the rest of them.
Right. So I think from the secular code perspective, the answer is it's just fine to accept the wine. Number one, size of the gift, as George noted, is a factor according to the CPA code. If you take a look at source number 24, a member or student who participates on an engagement team for an assurance client and the members or student's firm shall not accept a gift or hospitality, including a product or service discount from the client or a related entity, unless the gift or hospitality is clearly insignificant to the member, student, or firm, as the case may be. So maybe the Aga Khan's island was insignificant to Justin Trudeau. I don't know. But that's what he says. It has to be insignificant, then you're okay. That's number one. That's one reason why it's okay. Another is that this is being done out in the open, and that matters. I brought on the sheet. Oh, you know what? I did it. Oh, I see why. No, take a look at 25 first. Sorry. 25 is also about the size of the gift. This is from the Code of Conduct of Facebook. Giving or receiving gifts or entertainment to or from a current or future client or business partner can potentially create a conflict of interest, especially if the value of the item is significant. Accepting or providing gifts such as company-branded swag or simple gift baskets is generally fine if the market value of the item is less than $200 US and the gift is reasonable and customary, and does not inappropriately bias future decision-making about working with a client or partner or create an appearance of impropriety. And there's a lot more that they mention there. Interestingly, the next section right after this paragraph is where they talk about giving gifts to government officials. That would have been the very interesting part of this. You can go to the link and see that, what Facebook has to say. But that was just, I brought that here because they give you a dollar amount, which is actually a very common dollar amount that you see. The $200 threshold for some reason resonates with people. But another factor, as I mentioned, is that it's given out in the open. There's a company called Business Insider, which is a website also, which in 26, you see their conflict of interest policy, they say, it is unacceptable for anyone at Business Insider to accept cash or anything else of value in exchange for promotion, links, etc. in a story, especially if the relationship is not disclosed. There are certain instances in which we are given travel expenses or swag or other benefits for covering a story, and importantly, when we are given these things, we should always disclose it clearly. The idea that it is in the open is actually considered to be beneficial. Another point is that it should be what's considered routine in this kind of service. It's normal. They celebrate by giving out bottles of wine in the office. If you were to go back to the Facebook policy in source number 25, they talk about something being reasonable and customary, right? In the third into the fourth line, the gift is reasonable and customary. It's something that they normally do. I think another reason why this is okay is because, and this is sort of where I think what George was saying, is that it's given as part of the general distribution. They're not giving it specifically to you, walking up to the auditor and saying, here, have a bottle of wine, it's less than $200, and we're doing it in the open. They're giving everybody, and you're there working, and they're celebrating with you as well. Unless you argue that it makes you feel more like an employee, going back to our concern about feeling like you are one with them and their interests are your interests, but otherwise, they're not singling you out for a gift. So from a secular code standpoint, I think you're fine. I think from a halachic standpoint, we may really argue that this is at least a midas hasidus. As a matter of piety, you really shouldn't accept the gift. I think that would be the halachic side. That's case number one. Case number two. Oh, you know what? I also brought in that piece. I brought you the Members Integrity Act for the Parliament of Ontario, which talks about also that which is normal and routine. If you take a look at number 27, a member of the assembly shall not accept a fee, gift, or personal benefit that is connected directly or indirectly with the performance of his or her duties of office, but it doesn't apply to, among other things, a gift or personal benefit that is received as an incident of the protocol, customs, or social obligations that normally accompany the responsibilities of office. Okay. Case number two. Other services. Going back again to our case. Food Incorporated is impressed by the quality of the Bitachon LLP accountants and expresses interest in retaining them for risk assessment services in evaluating new markets for the expanding company. May Bitachon accept the added engagement? What would you say? Are they allowed to take this risk evaluation business on as well? Why not, David says. Anybody know why not?
It's a consulting engagement. If the company is a listed reporting issuer, they're not allowed to take consulting engagements.
Right. So there is a concern that is a heightened concern when you're dealing with a listed entity, a publicly traded company. There is a higher degree, a higher standard. But take a look at source number 28 from the CPA code. Firms have traditionally provided to their clients a range of non-assurance services that are consistent with their skills and expertise. The provision of such a non-assurance service is not subject to the requirements of Rule 204.1, all the conflict of interest stuff, because it's not an oversight of the company. And accordingly, does not require independence on the part of a member or firm. However, the provision of such a non-assurance service may create a self-interest, self-review, or advocacy threat that impacts the independence of the member or firm with respect to the provision of an assurance or specified auditing procedure service, right? For example, let's say you work for the company in terms of their taxes, and then the work that you do regarding the taxes is going to be evaluated as part of the audit that you're conducting. You're now in the position of reviewing your own work. That would be a self-review hazard. I see the connection is getting jumpy again, so I'm going to turn off my video. You potentially create a situation in which the work that you do with them when you are in this non-assurance capacity comes under review in your assurance capacity. So consequently, before a firm accepts an engagement to provide a non-assurance service, it should evaluate the significance of any threat to independence in relation to an existing assurance service that may be created by providing the non-assurance service. And so they give you a whole bunch of ways to deal with this problem, such as policies and procedures to prohibit members of the firm from making management decisions for the client or assuming responsibility for such decisions, all these things that are intended to help insulate you. But CPA code is very concerned about the possibility that someone who is auditing a firm is also going to provide non-assurance services. Halacha has a similar concern. Very interesting. Source number 29, a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, Talmud Yerushalmi. There's a place called Simonia, and the people there came to Rebbe, and they said to him, "We need you to send us a rabbi in a box. He's got to be everything. We want you to give us one person who will teach, judge, officiate, act as a scribe, teach children, and do all that we need." So that seems like an innocent request, but commentators are concerned about it because they want to know, in the event that he is the judge and also the scribe, potentially there is going to be a conflict of interest. And that's described in source number 30 in the Kovetz HaPoskim. On the Shulchan Aruch, there are two concerns in particular. Number one, this person is working as a scribe. Some wealthy person hires him to work on his documents. He writes documents for him. The guy pays very well. Then, this person is also a judge, and the wealthy person comes before him for a case. That's one case. Number two, a self-review concern is also mentioned in number 30. What if, as a scribe, you write a legal document, and then that document features in a case that comes before you as a judge? Right? Now you've got a problem. You're now in self-review. You're reviewing your own work. So therefore, in Jewish law, there is a concern as well for this kind of potential conflict of interest. Last case. We'll do this quickly. It's already 1:25. If you take a look at case number 3, and anybody who did not yet sign on, please make sure that you sign in before we're done. Someone sent me a note about the provision of large non-assurance services created the problems at Enron, the implosion of Anderson. It's true. The Enron case is one I've seen discussed in literature. I'm not as familiar with the Anderson case. But here's our case. As members of the same synagogue with children in the same class at school, Sarah and Rivka annually send each other mishloach manot, ritual gifts of food distributed for the holiday of Purim. One day, Rivka contacts Sarah. I realized that when I edited the cases, I skipped one piece of information. Sarah is the CEO of Bitachon LLP. And Rivka, on the other hand, has a company called Tikshoret. So one day, Rivka contracts Sarah to ask about retaining Bitachon LLP to provide assurance services for Tikshoret. So these are people who go to the same synagogue. Their kids are together in school. And they send each other gifts, these ritual gifts for Purim. Do the Mishloach Manot gifts disqualify Bitachon LLP from providing these services? They're gifts, but they were given in the past. You could stop giving the gifts now. Maybe we could argue that it was a past relationship. So because it's 127, I'm going to say this quickly. The CPA code is generally fine with a past relationship where it was a work relationship. They're good with that idea. But where there was a past social relationship, they are concerned for long-term friendships. If you take a look in source number 32, one of the concerns they have for a familiarity threat is, in the bullet point there, the long association of a senior person on the engagement team with the assurance client. That's where we would have concerns. In Jewish law, there are concerns as well. There are concerns in source number 33 in the Shulchan Aruch in a case in which a plaintiff sent a gift to a judge and then summoned the defendant to court in front of that judge. So the defendant cannot disqualify the judge unless the judge wishes to recuse himself from that case out of piety, since he knows his mind has become close to this person. So they say it would be good to back out. They stop short of disqualifying the judge. They say it would be good to back out. In source number 34, further writing from the rabbis clarifies that you can only judge the case if, number one, the gift was a random event. It's not an ongoing gift relationship. Number two, it can only be a small gift. And he specifies in the discussion, actually, Mishloach Manot, gifts for Purim, is a case that he brings. I didn't bring that part in this. So both of those will be required in order to be able to judge the case. We are concerned about prior relationships where those relationships are longstanding. That's the upshot. So again, what we've said is, yes, there is a concern in Jewish law as well as secular law about auditors accepting gifts. They were concerned that they lose their objectivity, even if their intentions are entirely good. The fear is for the responsibility to the client, as well as the responsibility to society and to the accounting profession. In secular law, we're very concerned about the secular code. We're concerned about the accounting profession. But we do our best to mitigate the risks. We know we can't get rid of them entirely. So in this case, we say small gifts that are routine and done in the open are fine. You should not be engaged in other services that might create a conflict of interest with auditing. And prior relationship, if it's a social relationship and it's a long-standing relationship, can indeed be a concern. Thank you very much, everybody. I'm sorry about the internet connection issues. And thank you for the added message about Anderson. They were the auditors of Enron. I didn't remember that. I remembered Enron. But thank you very much. All right. Be well. And